Welcome to the Stratfor podcast, focused on geopolitics and world affairs from stratfor.com. I'm your host, Ben Sheen.
The CME getting in on the Bitcoin action.
Warnings from major market players like Jamie Dimon haven't stopped hedge funds from betting big on Bitcoin.
Bitcoin is now being used to buy regular things from restaurants to retail, so why not real estate?
Today we're talking about the Bitcoin bubble.
That's right. In this episode of the podcast, we're diving into the world of blockchain, Bitcoin, and what these new technologies could really mean for companies, financial institutions, and society at large going forward. For part one, we sit down with Stratfor's senior science and technology analyst, Rebecca Keller, to better understand what Bitcoin and the underlying technology behind it called blockchain really are. And then in part two of the podcast, we're joined by Stratfor senior analysts, Matthew Bay and Mark Fleming Williams, to learn more about how people are just starting to use blockchain and other potential applications for the future. Thanks for joining us. And here with me today, we have Stratfor's senior science and technology analyst, Rebecca Keller, to talk a little bit about blockchain. Thanks for joining us today, Rebecca.
Good to be here.
So before we start to talk about blockchain, this revolutionary financial technology, I'd like to take a step back initially and talk a little bit about how it really came on the scene. And blockchain for many people is kind of synonymous with Bitcoin, which came on the scene initially in 2009 and came to define the idea of cryptocurrencies for many people. But the two are kind of interlinked, but one kind of broke away from the other. Can you tell me a little bit about the origins of Bitcoin and why blockchain is such an important part of its legacy?
So Bitcoin is a single application of a blockchain. So blockchain itself is the underlying technology of Bitcoin. And basically, what blockchain is it's a digital ledger. All that really means is it's computer code that starts the blockchain. But what you can think of it as is almost like a virtual wallet. Now, that wallet can contain a currency like Bitcoin, or it can contain information. And each person or participant in the blockchain has their own wallet and carries their own information. And then transactions, either the exchange of that information, whether it's like passing a ship's manifest to the dock, or it's exchanging Bitcoin like you would traditional paper money, you activate a signal to do that. That signal or that activation code is then verified, not by a single entity like a bank would verify a credit card or a transaction, but it's verified by the entire group in a distributed space throughout the network. And that's a key feature of the technology because it institutes a level of trust in it, because it's not just a single entity or a single person verifying the transaction. It's verified in groupthink almost, which helps prevent fraud.
So it's kind of hard to underestimate, isn't it, just how groundbreaking this was? Because clearly you mentioned some of the diverse applications for blockchain, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. But it certainly started off specifically based on a digital currency. And certainly one of the problems we found in the past with the idea of a digital currency is that through virtue of being electronic, it can be copied ad nauseum. So the whole issue of ownership becomes very complicated. So if you transfer digital currency to somebody, who's to say you don't simply retain the currency and you're just creating endless copies, which devalues it? And blockchain really sort of was the first thing that could overcome this in terms of peer-to-peer lending, right? You didn't require a third party to verify transactions.
Exactly. And so that timely aspect, or that security aspect where you don't want to devalue your currency, that's actually built into the technology of blockchain. So the block comes from the fact that all the transactions are grouped together in blocks. And what defines that block is a period of time. So all the computers or the nodes in the network are working to solve a mathematical equation. And that's called mining, and they get payments for that. And that's sort of where that phrase and that terminology is used a lot with Bitcoin. But what that does is it sets a set time limit, and it times transactions so you're able to track them and know what happened first and what happened where. And it really keeps the system honest. And that all comes back again to trust. And that's a huge, and I can't say it enough, that's a huge selling point and a huge attribute of this technology.
And I guess part of that is having there's this publicly viewable ledger, so anyone can interrogate the ledger and see the transactions that have taken place, which, like you say, keeps everyone honest. And I guess it's important to note that when Bitcoin first landed, a lot of people saw Bitcoin itself as being this revolutionary technology, but actually it was the blockchain behind it that really showed the promise. And we've seen blockchain evolve beyond Bitcoin to other digital currencies or other platforms such as Ethereum that have really taken this idea and then run with it.
Exactly. Ethereum's running even farther into like the differentiated computing space. It's certainly another avenue of investigation on a complete tangent. But yeah, absolutely. Again, it's the blockchain. It's the idea that you have this group, this group of computing power working in Congress, working together to do the transactions. There's no single node where anything is ever blocked up. There's no single node that can act as sort of the stopping point.
And it's interesting how when you start to talk about these game-changing financial tools, at some point they are going to fall under the blanket of regulation, and at some point they're going to fall into the mainstream. And we've seen this gradual acceptance of the blockchain technology as a legitimate tool in financial transactions. And in fact, we saw two banks, one in Australia, one in the United States, start to use blockchain applications to complete transactions as early as October 24th, 2016. How have things evolved since then? How much legitimacy does this technology really have now, Becca?
I mean, I think it has roughly the same legitimacy. We've seen, you know, it go back and forth. We saw China take measures to sort of remove it from circulation. And we've seen it in commercial transactions, you know, stores accepting Bitcoin. But there needs to be a lot more regulation and a lot more, and this is going to become funny because I'm going to go back to the word trust, but the general public doesn't trust it yet, even though the technology itself is so based on trust. It's going to take a while before we see it really, really permeate. And again, I don't know that Bitcoin will be the ultimate technology. First movers rarely are, but it really did start the movement.
Well, Rebecca, I look forward to hearing in the next segment some of the applications that blockchain can certainly be used for and the ways in which it's going to shape the future in many respects. Thank you so much for explaining this to me today. If you'd like to learn more about our analysis on blockchain and the impact that it and other disruptive technologies could have on broader geopolitical trends, visit us at worldview.stratfor.com. We'll include links to our related assessments in the show notes. And if you're not already a Worldview member, consider joining us to access all of our independent geopolitical analysis, forecasting, and industry insights on the core trends driving the international system. Information about individual, team, and enterprise memberships are available at worldview.stratfor.com/subscribe. Now to the second part of our podcast, where Stratfor senior analysts Matthew Bay and Mark Fleming-Williams join us to discuss innovative new applications of blockchain technology and its potential to shape the future.
My name is Matthew Bay. I'm a senior global analyst here at Stratfor, speaking from Austin, Texas. Joining me today to discuss blockchain, Bitcoin, and other things that are evolving in the world of digital ledger technology are Becca Keller, who is speaking from California, and also Mark Fleming-Williams from London. So let's start off with Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is the thing that has started discussing digital currencies and also the blockchain and everything else that goes with it. Mark, as an economic analyst, what do you think about Bitcoin and how that interacts with global currencies?
Thank you, Matthew. Bitcoin is an interesting creation. It obviously has attracted a lot of attention ever since it was first kind of launched onto the scene in the immediate aftermath of the financial crisis. It is a new type of asset in that it is completely kind of owned and completely decided by its, first of all, by its original code and structure, but also by its by the network that surrounds Bitcoin, which is largely online. As an asset, it's interesting, and it's interesting in currency because a lot of the conversations around it have involved whether it could rival traditional currencies, so the dollar or the yen or these things, and the answer is that it can't in a classic way. Well, at least not anytime soon. And the reason being because Bitcoin itself, the way it's structured, has got its finality written into its structure. So it's a little bit more like an asset than a currency or a modern currency. So it's a little bit more like a commodity like gold, in that the way Bitcoin is created, there will be a certain number of Bitcoins created there is a limit to the number of Bitcoins that can be created. Unlike, for example, the dollar, which is pretty much decided, as we've seen with quantitative easing, the supply can be expanded if needed. And so as a result, Bitcoin, that's one of the aspects which mean that it's going to struggle to challenge the traditional currencies on the global scale.
But there's also a question about control that's going on with Bitcoin. So one of the reasons that Bitcoin first emerged and why it got a lot of popularity was the fact that there was concern around quantitative easing, for that matter, and the central banks basically printing money endlessly, which is why the coders designed Bitcoin to actually have a deflationary tendency. But so if the trust factor, though, is if we do have a currency that is not controlled by a government, not controlled by anything, really, except for kind of the coding, I guess, how does that actually play into the calculus on whether or not it can actually replace the dollar or replace something that's backed by a national government?
So this is a conversation you and I have had in recent months. So the interesting thing about the fact that Bitcoin is owned and has its direction largely defined by the community behind it, makes it a less reliable asset perhaps than something like the dollar. And the reason for that being that what we've already been seeing so far this year is perhaps that community, which doesn't necessarily agree on everything, may decide to go in different directions with the currency. So what we've seen already this year is a hard fork, where the part of the community decided that they wanted Bitcoin to be something different, and they took an aspect of Bitcoin off in another direction, meaning that an investor then has a choice. Do you stick with Bitcoin or do you go with this new one? Or do you go with both, absolutely. Although you've only got a certain amount of money, but do you go with both? With the dollar, for example, with a currency, instead of being backed by the decisions, instead of all the decisions being made by all of the Bitcoin community, the decisions largely are being made by the US government and the US Federal Reserve. And so what that means is when you're buying the dollar, you're buying the US, basically. You're buying into the belief that government will continue to control that area and will continue to issue this currency and will continue to regulate it. When you've got a Bitcoin, a cryptocurrency, which is owned and decided by this community whose faces you can't see and who you don't necessarily fully know their motives, there is a different level of risk attached as well. So that's another potential drawback with Bitcoin compared to a currency.
One of the things, though, that actually does kind of work in its favor that's interesting to point out is that you just mentioned how, you know, not knowing your customer, that's a concern, which is legitimate. But at the same time, when we talk about the way that credit cards work or the way that debit cards work, there's always the risk of the person not paying it in the end, or calling your bank account basically and saying that, hey, you know what, I didn't actually make that payment. So there's always that risk premium that's basically going to insurance type companies over whether or not merchants will get their payments. And one thing that Bitcoin does is, since it actually transfers the funds immediately and you don't actually get the transaction to go through unless you actually have the funds in your account, is you get around that. So from a merchant's perspective, it's actually a good thing because it's not reversible. From a customer's perspective, that's the opposite risk.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this actually quite neatly takes us onto so Bitcoin itself has its advantages, has its flaws. But I think what we can agree on is that blockchain, some of the functioning technology underlying Bitcoin, is exciting and has a lot of potential future benefits, which could go in all sorts of different directions.
One of the great things, though, about Bitcoin and the technology is that it's a digital ledger, essentially. So what it is it takes all the transactions that we've seen throughout the entire system that it's been around. It essentially is just calculating and adding up all of that so everybody can see it in a public way. That's then allows to have a lot more confidence in the system and the way that things are being worked, whether or not somebody has money, whether or not they can actually afford to give you something and things. So that is something that then is then calculated essentially by the blockchain in a way that builds consensus around everybody who is on the network. So for example, if I'm calculating my own ledger, you're calculating your own ledger, and then you try to insert something that's frivolous, but everybody else agrees with me, then that actually won't go into the system. So the blockchain essentially can develop consensus around something that you wouldn't necessarily get otherwise. And then that concept, that consensus building concept of the blockchain, is what's really significant. It can be used to do a currency, but it can also be used in a number of different applications, some of which we're actually seeing in finance already. So for example, one of the things that I personally think's got a lot of potential is in the area of transactions. One of the things that we've seen is Ripple, which is set up like Bitcoin, but its design isn't so much to be a currency as much as it is in order to use currencies to quickly go across international borders in a payment system. Right now, international payments are dominated by central banks. They're dominated by a few banking houses. They're dominated by SWIFT, which is the communications network that banks talk to internationally. And that's something that we've seen in geopolitics and have a very significant impact, where the United States, for example, can say, hey, SWIFT, you have to cut off Iran from transactions. That then cuts off Iran from the international financial system. Something that's Ripple would allow basically banks to communicate with each other that the United States or other countries cannot, you know, lock down. And it also breaks the dominance that the few banks that are involved in that area today are in. So that's one area where blockchain can then be used for something that's not Bitcoin, not a currency in its purest form, but it has a currency that underpins the system. But then you have an application that is significant in the financial sector that's well beyond just a currency.
So taking a step back, we've talked a lot about the financial implications for this technology, but it actually has a broader view than that. Looking at the trust aspect is important for more than just finance. It's important in supply chains and looking at how the movement of physical goods as opposed to just currency or financial assets. So I think because we don't have the problem or the constraint of the need for a government backing like you would with a currency, that we could probably see blockchain as a technology implemented more quickly in those kind of industries where it's used to track goods, and that ledger part of the technology is the driving factor. So as we see it, to increase efficiency in supply chain operations. And so just making sure we continue to look past finance as a sole user of this technology.
That's absolutely right, Beck. Another industry where we are seeing it as having an impact, or at least research going into that, is the health sector. So obviously, patients' records is a big thing that are obviously people want to keep relatively confidential, but it is still a mechanism where we can see that trust aspect, but also some sort of a still transparency and an anonymity aspect that allows then this to be a more efficient way to transfer health records. So there's that aspect of it. So we're starting to see it in other sectors as well, such as the computing sector. We're seeing it in the health sector. We're seeing it in the shipping sector. We're going to probably see it in agriculture. We're probably going to be seeing it more in economics beyond just finance. So there are definitely a lot of other applications.
Basically, wherever trust and consensus are a key benefit or a key attribute of the industry, we can expect to see blockchain make its way in.
Yeah, and another area that's not even really a sector that we're starting to see it emerge is actually just in the way of doing distributed computing. So another one of the pilot programs that's out there is Ethereum. So Ethereum was essentially designed to have a distributed computing network that is along, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 different computers or however many is connected to the internet, and that is able to then run programs or run different sort of, you know, classical programs, whether it be something that's in the finance sector, whatever application that a company or a person that's on the system wants to be used. And then it uses blockchain to distribute that power, processing power, throughout the system, and then that one computer or a network of computers would then perform that code, and essentially you would be paying whatever currency that is underpinning the system, in this case it's Ether, to do something. So this actually gives you a distributed computer that nobody can shut down, that can be always running, always on, and then running all kinds of different codes that's really in a different way than we see computing being done now. This obviously will have the implications for the finance sector if you want to use it to run programs for smart contracts. So that's going to be contracts that automatically go into force whenever something happens, or much more complicated than that, obviously. That's just the simplest version, I guess. But then also, just if you think about just running programs in general, whether that be nefarious reasons or positive reasons, you still have that system work. So that's another application that takes away from just, you know, the idea of ledger and having counting things, and then just broadening out to a way that you just distribute information to begin with.
That's it for this episode of the Stratfor podcast. For more analysis on blockchain, Bitcoin, and other disruptive technologies, please visit us at Stratfor Worldview. We'll include links to related reading in the show notes. And if you're not already a Stratfor Worldview member, be sure to visit us at worldview.stratfor.com/subscribe to learn more about individual, team, and enterprise-level access. Worldview members can continue this conversation in our members-only forum. That's where you can engage directly with other readers, as well as Stratfor analysts, editors, and contributors. If you have a comment or an idea for a future episode of the podcast, email us at podcast@stratfor.com or give us a call on 1-512-744-4300, extension 3917, to leave a message. If you have a moment, also consider leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever you subscribe to the podcast. We really appreciate your feedback. And for more geopolitical intelligence, analysis, and forecasting that brings global events into valuable perspective, follow us on Twitter @Strat4. Thanks for listening.